We are looking at Milwaukee crime statistics from 2019. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Yesterday, Mayor Tom Barrett was joined by the Milwaukee Police Department and the City Health Department giving a review of criminal activity. He was comparing 2019 figures to the city's five-year trend. There's been a 34% drop in homicides in Milwaukee over the past 5 years.
We know even with that dramatic decrease in homicides that there is still too much violence in some parts of our city. One homicide is one homicide too many.
What questions do you have about Milwaukee's crime figures? Do you live in Milwaukee? Does it feel like the city is safer today than a year ago or in the past 5 years? We're at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's also a past journalism fellow at Marquette, where she investigated crime patterns and policing strategies. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So homicides spiked in 2015, but they've fallen every year since. What do Milwaukee leaders think is causing this drop?
So Milwaukee leaders have really cited collaboration. They've cited new strategies put in place by both the health department and the Milwaukee Police Department. On the Milwaukee Police Department side, there's a real emphasis on these shoot reviews, as Police Chief Alfonso Morales calls them. They're weekly meetings where they're reviewing every shooting, fatal and non-fatal, in the city from the week prior, and they are trying to get in front of that, stop retaliation, and basically really focus on that violent crime. And in the health department side, you have the Office of Violence Prevention that's really been trying to also interrupt violence through a public health approach using their 414 Life team, as well as both departments crediting active community involvement to make the city safer.
What is the 414 Life team?
So the 414 Life team is a group that is, they're trained health workers. They're considered credible messengers, and their job is to go out and try to intermediate or try to mediate in disputes before they escalate and turn violent. There's also a hospital responder program that's very key, where they are partnering with Frederick Hospital to meet with shooting victims, Frederick and Ascension of Wisconsin. So they're meeting with shooting victims in the hospital and trying to see what supports they need and try to make sure that a cycle of violence stops there.
So it sounds like we're hearing more of an integrated approach to lowering homicides in the city.
I think that's absolutely fair to say. I know in the past, other elected leaders, public officials, as well as policymakers and other stakeholders have really focused on trying to, as they often say, get out of their silos, make sure people are working together. Milwaukee has a long history of trying innovative things to address crime, and some show early success, and sometimes they falter because of leadership changes or because of changes in funding streams, that sort of thing. So I think there's a real desire in the city right now to make sure that does not happen in this particular case.
We saw, Ashley, non-fatal shootings also peak in 2015. They've dropped off as well. The number of non-fatal shootings last year was the lowest since 2011. What is happening there?
I think just taking a step back broadly, it can be really difficult to untangle what is causing crime to go up or down. I think you can certainly identify, as these public officials have, contributing factors, what they believe is working. And so you do have an overarching pattern of both homicides and non-fatal shootings peaking in 2015 and declining since then. As far as the non-fatal shootings, I think from the police department's perspective, there's a very real focus right now in treating every non-fatal shooting as if it were a homicide, because in many ways it almost was. It's a very serious crime, and often but for, you know, the location of the injury or the medical help or any other factors, that may have been a homicide. So there's a real focus in the police department right now of trying to address those non-fatal shootings, solve them as quickly as possible, or at least make progress in those investigations so that you are preventing the next shooting or, you know, the next possible homicide.
We're talking with Ashley Luthern, who covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're looking at Milwaukee's crime statistics from last year that were released yesterday. Ashley, let's look at carjacking for a moment. There's been a lot of attention in Milwaukee on carjackings and reckless driving. What do the new statistics show in this area?
So I think first, I should note that carjackings are not typically, you know, they're not typically broken out when you look at what's called the Uniform Crime Reporting System statistics. Those are the ones that, you know, every city is using across the country. They're usually kind of included within that subset of robbery because, you know, it's an armed robbery of a vehicle. So I know the police department has made a concerted effort, you know, going to 2014 and possibly even earlier to break out those numbers because people are so concerned about carjackings and because it's a specific kind of crime. And so the numbers released yesterday show that at least in the past 3 years, from 2017 going all the way to to last year, they are declining. There were 346 carjackings reported last year. That's still almost, you know, one a day if you were looking at an average of 365 days a year. But that is down compared to 383 and 452 carjackings reported in 2017.
Milwaukee, and Milwaukee is one of seven cities expecting more federal aid this year to fight violent crime. Do you know what kind of help is coming its way?
Yes, that was something I asked Chief Morales. As you know, last month, the U.S. Attorney General announced Milwaukee was one of seven cities targeted for this help. So the chief said he anticipates a lot of this funding will be bolstering the U.S. Marshals Service and their work in partnership with the Milwaukee Police Department and those other targeted cities to try to quickly find and arrest wanted suspects nationwide. I think that's going to the goal, as the chief told me, of accountability. You know, if you're identifying suspects within those 48 hours, you're taking them into custody, that is a sign of accountability and for community members to see that a problem was being addressed quickly.
Who is most likely to be a victim of violent crime in Milwaukee?
I think when we look at violent crime, it is often, it follows patterns that researchers have noted for years. It tends to concentrate in cities of, or in neighborhoods of economic disadvantage. They typically are communities of color. They typically have socioeconomic statistics, again, that are below the citywide average. Crime can be very, very localized. There are some who argue we shouldn't, you know, a citywide rate can be somewhat misleading because in some neighborhoods the rate is much higher. And so year after year, the city's statistics have shown that the people most likely to be victimized are men, usually young men, but not always. We've seen that age rising a little bit of color in the city of Milwaukee.
You know, Milwaukee leaders yesterday, they were touting homicide rates falling over the past 5 years. You've studied crime patterns in the city over decades. Does a five-year period give us enough of a snapshot to know that real changes are happening?
That is a great question. I think it's certainly better than just looking year to year, which I know that we often do because that is important to our readers and to the community to know what's happening year to year. I think 5 years is a good chunk of time to try to draw some sort of trend line. But really, you know, I know in my story, we put out information going all the way back to 2006. And when you do that, you can really see the lows in both the homicides and the non-fatal shootings that occurred in 2008, 2009, really through 2012, you know, that period where homicides were between 71 and 91 throughout that particular five-year period. So I think it's important context to just show these trend lines. And I think it's important to remember that in 2015, there was a spike in homicides, not just in Milwaukee, but in many other cities. And that's something that researchers and policymakers and, you know, including police departments across the country are still trying to figure out what exactly happened there.
Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ashley Luthern covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about grassroots donations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So we learned in recent days that Democratic small-dollar donors gave $1 billion through an online fundraising platform. It's called Act Blue, and that was in 2019. So it's one indicator that online giving is adding up. Grassroots donors are responding with donations as small as a dollar. And the more transactions, the more processing fees flow to credit card companies. Do you think about overhead costs associated with donations? How do you feel about candidates who have a lot of small donors to their campaigns? We're at 800-642-1234. Robin Kolodny is a professor and chair of the political science department at Temple University, where she studies campaign finance and American political parties. Robin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, since 2008's presidential election, political campaigns have been paying more money in credit card processing fees. And part of that is because there are just simply more small dollar donations. People are donating more frequently online. What's behind this trend of more small dollar donations?
Well, it's interesting you should point out 2008, because that was part of the Obama campaign's successful strategy to ask more people for money. Before the last big campaign finance reform bill in 2003, there was a lot of incentive to get a lot of money from fewer people. So they didn't ask everyone. Well, it turned out that there were a lot more people who did want to go ahead and give to campaigns, but yes, in smaller amounts. And they found that that was just as effective. So in 2008, the Obama campaign succeeded in using social media platforms and the internet broadly, Facebook, things like this, to draw those smaller donors in, and had an enormous amount of success with it.
Social media platforms were largely in their infancy in those days. We've seen evolution there. We've seen certainly such fraught issues with Facebook and advertising. How are campaigns using social media these days and garnering dollars for their war chests?
Well, let me make it clear, especially when it comes to small donors. As you said before, the fees can be high. The cost can be sometimes higher than the donation if it's only a few dollars. So it's not necessarily always for cash that they need the small donors. The more people that you have who would click a button and give you their bank details for even $5 or $10, that person's a voter for you. And that person is probably more than a voter. They're more likely to volunteer for your campaign, and they're probably likely to put on a bumper sticker or a lawn sign or talk to somebody else about the campaign. So in a way, you're getting a lot more than the few dollars, that you're getting an advocate. And that is really the gift of the small donor process, is that while you are also obviously, and for the most part, a lot of people are giving $20, $25, and certainly you're getting some money from that, but you're really getting a team.
So it's like a gateway to many more things. That small donation can give you even a lot of information on what that voter might be thinking about.
Exactly. Especially because, as you're saying today, we've matured to the point where we can figure out maybe what the ad was that the person clicked on to get to the site, what the platform is that they're using. Obviously, we're going to have an address if we have a credit card number, so we can find out where the enthusiasts are clustering. There's a lot of different things that we can do with that person. But a campaign would say, mostly, we've just hit somebody new that we want to keep in touch with.
So the smaller a donation, the larger portion of that donation goes to credit card companies and fixed fees rather than to the candidate. So smaller donations mean credit card companies are, and other middlemen are making money. Given the rise of small donations, is that significant?
Well, I wouldn't say it's any more significant than the other middle people who were making money previously. When you have big dollar fundraisers, let's say, maybe somebody's giving $1,000, but you're going to hold it at the Ritz-Carlton, and you can't necessarily get their meal for less than a couple hundred dollars and valet parking and so forth. If you think about it that way, you might have been taking in more dollars, but percentage-wise, it really isn't what you might be thinking of. And the same way before we had the internet, we had direct mail. So we would send out we meaning candidates and parties, millions and millions of letters and only maybe get a few hundred back. So that was postage. That the U.S. Postal Service, by the way, makes a lot of money off of campaigns. So there are a lot of vendors in between. And, of course, the other middle person that benefits from campaign outputs when they spend the money are TV and radio stations, especially television.
We're talking with Robin Kolodny. She's a political scientist from Temple University. We're looking at the nature of grassroots campaigns and small dollar donations. Robin, the Democratic National Committee also changed its requirements for candidates to participate in debates. Candidates now need a minimum number of unique donors to be able to get on the debate stage. Do you think using that metric, that threshold, makes sense?
Well, they're actually copying something that's in the original law from the 70s when presidential candidates used to rely more on public matching funds. And that was the same thing, is what they were trying to do is make sure that the candidates who were going to get the public funding actually had a large base that was not geographically unique. So in other words, and this is the same thing that Democrats are trying to do, it wouldn't be so hard to make the dollar amount if you were from a state or a locality where you were a celebrity of some sort. And what they're trying to do is make sure that that's not really the case. It isn't just some kind of favorite son or daughter that's taking up a space on the debate stage when a more viable candidate who had broader support should be doing that. So they're just trying to make sense out of really what is a new territory for them, because they're, you know, in 2016, this is the new thing, is that both parties are getting far more serious contenders than they ever envisioned previously.
So despite how the presidential candidates do go after each other on large donors, does our political system still favor large donors and these so-called bundlers who fundraise basically off the payroll of the campaigns?
Well, of course it does, but I'm one of these people who wouldn't focus so much on the money as much as I would ask people to think about what makes our whole political and economic system run. So it's about 80% of Americans work for the private sector. And when you think about it that way, it shouldn't be a surprise that then large employers, meaning large businesses, are the ones that have more sway one way or another with lawmakers. Sometimes that helps that you have campaign donations because you might have a little bit easier access. But in any city, the largest private employer is able to get meetings whether they give money or not. So the bias is already there. And sometimes I think that the campaign donations just draw our attention to it, and maybe in a different way than it should.
So is there an image when you see these 2020 candidates encouraging people to donate in small amounts? Does that help their image in any way?
Well, of course it does. But again, it's sincere, especially on the Democratic side. So for decades, the Democrats trailed Republicans in fundraising. And this really didn't reverse until it's just about 20 years ago that it began to be at parity. And now that the Democrats, in most cases, will outraise the Republicans. And the reason why is just because they have more donors. It doesn't matter the amount, that you have more people that are willing to give, that will eventually add up. And so previously, the Democrats' advantage always was in having foot soldiers. Previously, it might have been labor unions when they had more membership, let's say in the 70s. The people weren't giving cash so much as they were time. And again, I go back to my original point, both are valuable.
So does a large number of small donors actually tell us anything about a campaign or how it's run?
It tells me that the campaign is spreading its message as widely as possible, that it's trying very hard to get people who maybe aren't as consistent at voting or maybe new voters, and that's what is very time-consuming. Because we spend so much time thinking about things like campaign ads on television, we lose sight of what is really effective, which is that door-to-door contact, having events, having people talk about the campaign. A lot of Americans need that kind of prompting to get engaged.
Robin, as you look at the landscape of campaign finance, what are you keeping an eye on?
Oh, that's very interesting. I guess I am keeping an eye on what we're talking about now is about how you can expand the number of people that participate. And I am firmly of the belief we should spend less time worrying about things like super PACs. I always like to point out that if a super PAC has to spend many millions of dollars to get your attention, is that because they're in a strong position or in a weak position? I can tell you there's many other companies in the United States who have a lot of access and policy and don't actually give any money to campaigns at all. That makes you a bit more powerful if you don't have to do that. So that's the thing that I think that we should pay attention to, how people are responding to those appeals, the ordinary people, and not so much just to the elites.
Robin, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Robin Kolodny is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Temple University, where she studies campaign finance. Coming up, we look at the state of retail in 2020, check on the retail industry, how it's doing right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the state of the retail industry in 2020 here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What we do know is that it's a very uncertain time for big box stores and low-cost retailers. There's a potential fallout from tariff tensions. There's a potential economic downturn. So 1 year ago this week, Shopko filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Others that went down this past year, Gymboree, Payless, Shoe Source, Forever 21. Have you seen a national retailer close recently in your area? Which one? How has that affected your shopping habits? Did you work for a retailer that shut down? Could you find another job? We're at 800-642-1234. Charlie O'Shea is a vice president and retail analyst at Moody's Investor Service. Moody's is a provider of credit ratings, research, and risk analysis. Charlie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be here.
So why are you seeing more U.S. department stores filing for bankruptcy? What's going on?
Well, I think let's look at retail in a broader context for a second. We saw a huge boom in new store construction during, I would say, from 2000, say, till 2012. And that occurred at the same time that there was kind of a nascent shift going on online with Amazon and some of the other pure play online guys, as well as some of the brick and mortar. So when you look at the landscape in 2012, there were far too many stores. And we're still struggling with a square footage issue in retail, although I think the stores, the individual store concepts and amounts are starting to stabilize a little bit. There's still too much square footage. So you deal with that. Then a lot of these companies that have run into trouble have been subjects of leverage buyouts. They're owned by financial sponsors. They have too much debt. And one of the kind of buzz phrases around here is you can't outrun debt. And a lot of these companies just couldn't do it. When you layer the debt load on top of the investments necessary to make the change into a, you know, an online world, you just don't have enough money. I mean, think about the family budget. When you know you get your paycheck, you've only got X amount of dollars to handle everything. And if there's something new happening or an unforeseen event, you can't deal with it. And that's what happened in retail. You know, there were a lot of retailers, 06, 07, 08, that were bought by sponsors. And I don't think it's fair to say that anybody should really have seen the explosion in online back in 2005, 2006, 2007. Amazon was pretty small back then. And it was still kind of, yeah, it's getting there. Even in 2012, we published a piece in November of 2012. Online sales were only about 7% of U.S. retail sales. Now they're 16, 17, depending on how you categorize it. But it was difficult back then to envision what would happen. And what has happened is the world's gotten a lot more complicated for retailers, and it's tough. It's really tough. I've been covering the sector for 17-plus years here and years before that, and I've never seen it more competitive and tougher to do business if you're not well-capitalized, large, strong, et cetera.
Yeah, what I'm hearing, too, is it's been a time of reset, resizing, and managing risk.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think when you look at the challenges facing retailers right now, again, you've got what I mentioned before. You've got to be able to invest in your stores because the store is still going to be 80 to 90% of your revenue. We're at, you know, roughly 85, 83% of U.S. retail sales are still done in a store. So they're still important. You need an online presence, and you need to manage your balance sheet. So you've basically got a three-legged stool here. And if one of those legs doesn't work well, you don't have a stool anymore, you're sitting on the ground. And a lot of the retailers that don't have the financial flexibility haven't been able to execute those strategies. It's no secret that the best performing retailers are the biggest ones. You've got Walmart, Target, Costco, Best Buy, Amazon, and then on the off-price side, you've got TJX and Ross. And these guys have had the money, they've had the ability to execute a strategy, and they've been able to get time. And time is important. You can't do this overnight. It takes a lot of money, but it also takes time. It took Amazon a long time to get to a point where it was stable and scaled, and that was without a brick-and-mortar business to run. I would argue that it's harder to take a brick-and-mortar business and build an online business than it is to build an online business from scratch without brick-and-mortar.
Charlie, where are these companies accumulating so much debt? Is it from building stores? Where is that debt coming from?
Some of it's that, but a lot of it came from, and if you look at, you know, if you go back and look over the last 5 or 6 years at the retailers that have defaulted, which for us is a broader term than just filed for bankruptcy, because we consider payment defaults, and we also consider something called a distressed exchange, where a company swaps debt, existing debt, for better terms to avoid a default. If you look at that landscape, you'll find an awful lot of those companies were subject to leverage buyouts led by management or led by financial sponsors. That loads companies up with debt. I covered Toys R Us for 15 years, and when Toys did its leverage buyout, picked up about $7 billion worth of debt, and it never got out from under it. It's very hard for management to run a company, particularly in this environment, where, again, you've got to make all these investments, and you've got to come up with a strategy. You've got to sometimes execute it on the fly. And if you're worried about the next debt maturity, you can't think about your strategy. One of the things that we've talked about a lot here at Moody's is CEOs are made to run businesses. They are not made to go sit and negotiate with bankers. And I think what you'll find over the last several years with the companies that have had problems, those CEOs have had to do things that they shouldn't have to do. They've got to sit down with bankers. They've got to explain their businesses, walk through business plans. That takes their eye off the ball of running a company, and it's really hard to run a retailer these days.
Talking with Charlie O'Shea, he's a vice president and retail analyst at Moody's Investor Service, and he oversees coverage of companies like Walmart and Target and Amazon. What are your thoughts on retailers having to close down? What concerns do you have? How should that issue be addressed in your community? Are you a small business owner? Has your location perhaps benefited from a national retailer going out of business? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie, is Amazon as dominant as we might think?
Depends on what lens you look through. If you look at it through an online lens, yes. If you look at it through a total U.S. retail lens, no. We estimate U.S. retail, just keep the math simple. It's easier for me to think that way. U.S. retail sales are about $4 trillion. Amazon, adding the third-party business is, you know, $250, $300, depending on how you weigh the third-party business. So in terms of online sales, and we assume online sales are about 16 or 17% of retail. So doing the math, Amazon is dominant online. They've got 40-plus percent of the online market share in the U.S., but that's not that big when you scale it to the entire U.S. Walmart does roughly $400 billion in revenue in the U.S., including Sam's. So Amazon, yes, it's dominant online. One of the things that Amazon is dealing with now is the power of brick and mortar to leverage those assets to support its online business. Buy online, pick up in store has become a huge weapon for brick and mortar. If you really want something same day, in almost all of the U.S., the only way to get it is to go to the store. Amazon bought Whole Foods. Our premise with the Whole Foods purchase was it was having trouble scaling its food business without brick and mortar. It's got brick and mortar. Whole Foods is performing fairly well. It's still a small player in food. So when you look at Amazon, you look at it and say, okay, if I'm looking to buy something online, my search is going to start with Amazon. I think that's a given. But Amazon isn't always going to be the best price, nor going to provide you with the product as quickly as you may want. So the challenge for a brick-and-mortar retailer is to be that second site. So if you bounce off Amazon, you go there. That said, Amazon has Amazon Web Services, the cloud storage business, which generates huge profits, steady profitability, and it allows Amazon to absorb some of the things that it has to do on the retail side, like Prime one-day delivery, which is going to cost the company $4 to $4.5 billion in 2019 and will cost money during 2020 as well. Amazon is doing everything it can to keep its Prime members happy, and it costs money to do that. Mm. And one of the ways to keep Prime members happy is get them product faster so that they don't decide to take advantage of a buy online, pick up in store offer from a brick and mortar retailer.
Well, let's take a call on this. Marianne is joining us from Superior. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. As I was telling your screener, I have been living in Superior all my life, and I was here for our boom time, and then I was here to watch the deterioration and the bust that happened. And I'm very happy to report that I am seeing in our downtown and Belknap Avenue corridor many small businesses, at least 17 or 18, that are doing a very good business and working very hard, but they're small community businesses that are giving one of the things that I have seen lost in big box is customer service.
Marianne, thanks for the call. Charlie, Marianne seeing on her main street that small businesses are a win right now because of relationships with customers.
No question. There is definitely a place for the small retailer in this environment. The small retailer needs to do exactly what your caller just said. They have to provide great customer service. You've got to hang on to those customers. You've got to cherish them. You've got to treat them like gold. If someone takes the time to come to your store, you have to make it worth their while because it's a big commitment. It's a big investment of time to go to a brick-and-mortar store when you could very easily sit on your couch, pull out a tablet or your phone, and buy something online without going through the quote-unquote hassle of going to the store. So these retailers, the smaller, niche-y ones, have got to identify their customers. They've got to take care of them. They have to find a way to market to them, be it online, through the mail, whatever, and just hold on to those relationships. If you look at the success of Best Buy over the last several years, it's because of the store experience and the way they treat their customers and the expertise in those stores.
We have to pause right there with Charlie O'Shea as we get a read on the retail industry. Back in a moment with Moody's Charlie O'Shea right here on the Ideas Network. We're getting a read on the state of the retail industry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So it seems like going out of business sales are around every corner. There was Shopko and GameStop, Gap, other chains shut down more than 9,300 stores last year, making it the biggest year ever for store closings. We have our eye this year on JCPenney, Bed Bath & Beyond, Pier 1. Were you a frequent Shopko shopper? What are your thoughts on the store closing last year? Are you concerned that your favorite store will be next? 800-642-1234. Charlie O'Shea stays with us. He's a vice president at Moody's, tracking Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and other retailers. Let's go back to the phones now. Ray is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
The big problem I have with Amazon and a lot of the big tech companies is they have figured out how to game our tax system. And brick-and-mortar stores wind up paying state and local taxes. They keep our schools going. They keep the roads right. But Amazon, this gigantic whale, pays zero in taxes. how in the world can this be good for us? And I say in 10 years, I'd love to have this conversation again when it's just Amazon and a couple of giant online companies, and you will be able to buy nothing locally.
Ray, thanks for the call. He sees the demise here and a faulty tax structure. Charlie?
I don't think we're going to be living in a world where it's just Amazon and a few brick-and-mortar retailers. I think that the brick-and-mortar retailers have demonstrated significant resilience over the last few years once they decided to get into the business and get into online in a big way. They hadn't invested in it in the past, and now they are, and you've got Walmart growing its online business 30-40% a year, Target, same thing. So I think the fears of Amazon, much like I've covered Walmart for a long time, and when Walmart was rolling out supercenters, there were worries that it was just going to destroy Main Street retail. And it did take some market share away from Main Street retail. You don't get the $500 billion in revenue without taking share from somebody. But the better Main Street type retailers, as we talked about earlier, have basically survived. They've come out the other side. They figured out how to take care of their customers, and they're doing okay. As far as the tax situation is concerned, that's not something I'm ready to address at this point. I really didn't prep on that part of it. But yeah. Amazon employs a lot of people, and they pay a lot of wages, and those employees pay an awful lot in income taxes. And Amazon is, you get tax deductions for investment, and Amazon invests heavily, and that creates a lot of jobs. So I think we have to look a little bit deeper into the tax question to really find out what's happening here.
Let's go to John now in Delafield. John, hi.
Hi, good morning. I agree with the previous comment. I mean, Amazon is, I'm sure, full compliance with the tax code. They don't have an obligation to pay any more than they're entitled to, and they're a great employer. But my question pertains more to the bricks and mortar investments that they've made in terms of not just the fulfillment centers, but what we see for drop-off and pick-up locations. And I'm curious if Mr. O'Shea can comment on whether that's an evolving trend. And we'll see more and more of that, and even actual storefronts with products from the likes of online retailers.
Oh, are you talking about those drop boxes where you can return products and things like that, John?
Yes, that's okay. Part of it. And then I'm also curious if you'll see storefronts, in other words, like traditional bricks and mortar storefronts, but fully funded and staffed by the online retailers.
Yeah. Charlie, what do you see out there?
Well, if you're a pure play online retailer and you ignore brick and mortar, you are ignoring 80%+ of retail sales in the U.S. So I think you need both. And I think we're seeing that with Amazon. You know, the Amazon Go stores, Amazon, the five-star stores, the investment in Whole Foods. So, and Bonobos is open brick and mortar. Warby Parker's open brick and mortar. So I think there's obviously relevance to both, and I think you really do need both to be successful. The brick-and-mortar retailers, those stores are assets. They're not liabilities. The accountants got that right. They are assets. And what I think you'll see, and you'll see more of it going forward, is those stores being milked for everything they're worth from both a brick-and-mortar perspective and an online perspective. You'll see shipping from store, which has been going on for a while. Target does that. You'll see, you know, the buy online, pick up in store. You can't do a buy online, pick up in store without a store, obviously. So I think, you know, we've talked about store closures a lot during this conversation. We haven't hit it head on, and I'll try to do that right now. And this will answer John's question, I think, a little bit better. Retailers really need to think before they close a store, because if you close a store, as your first caller mentioned, it's devastating to that market for your brand. You know, I'm not going to delve into the social stuff, but you lose brand identity. And one thing that we've been tracking, and it's still early stages, obviously, but when a brick-and-mortar retailer closes a store in a certain demographic, in a certain market, they lose online sales in that market because they lose their brand identity. And people are more likely, if they're going to buy online from a brick-and-mortar retailer, will buy from a brick-and-mortar retailer that's not far from their house, so in case something goes wrong, they can return it. Mm-hmm. So you've got to just unleash those stores, and you'll see them. You know, Kohl's' relationship with Amazon, for instance. I don't cover Kohl's anymore, but that Amazon relationship is a traffic driver, and it's a positive. You'll see, you know, Redbox or the lockers that Amazon uses in various retailers. Anything you can do to get the customer what they want, when they want it, how they want it, is the way you have to run yourself as a retailer these days. The consumer's ruling everything, and the retailers have to recognize that.
Talking with Charlie O'Shea, he's a lead retail analyst at Moody's Investor Service. We're looking at the state of retail in 2020 and where we were in 2019. So, Charlie, I know you don't cover Kohl's, which is based here in Wisconsin. Kohl's is saying, though, that same-store sales during November and December was a little bit off, fell slightly due to a weakness in its women's apparel business. And on the whole, department stores were expected to underperform this holiday season. How tough is competition between department store chains and Target and Walmart?
It's acute. It's very acute right now, and you'd have to throw Amazon in the mix as well because Amazon's selling more apparel. It's really hard. You've got Walmart and Amazon and Target, all three of them, and I'll put Target aside for a second. Walmart and Amazon have been fighting a battle for market share across categories for, I think we're going on 4 years now, if my math is right. And that's hard to compete with because they can source cheaper. They have more financial flexibility. They've got stronger balance sheets. They've got more cash. They can basically, you know, promote and keep things on sale until you can't anymore. And I wouldn't focus so heavily on the sales component here. And I know equity analysts do that, and it's a great headline. But we at Moody's focus on operating income. So selling a dollar for 99 cents is not the way we like companies to do business. So at some point in a heavily promotional environment like we saw this past holiday, and we're still seeing, I mean, the holiday's not over. January, in my mind, is still part of the holiday. What we saw this holiday was heavy promotions. At some point, the limbo bar gets too low price-wise, and you have to walk away. And I think the savvy retailers recognize that, you know what, not all sales are created equal. Not every sale is a good sale. We have to be disciplined. And I think you're seeing a fair amount of that out there right now where, you know, Amazon shareholders don't really worry that much about profitability. And with AWS generating $10 billion a year in operating profit, the retail business can, you know, break even. And the company is still in really good shape. There aren't many retailers out there that have that luxury. In fact, none of them do. So it's important that they focus on the things that they're good at, and it's important they focus on maximizing profits as best they can. And if that means walking away from some low-profit sales or non-profitable sales, then that's what they need to do.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Kate. It was great being with you.
Charlie O'Shea is a vice president and retail analyst at Moody's Investors Service. Just ahead, we continue a series on health throughout the different stages of life. Today, it's all about our 20s. We talk with a physician about eating nutritiously, avoiding common causes of illness, and doing things that generally promote health and well-being in later decades. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.